I can't really tell you for sure.
Because I'm sitting my rose in. And I wasn't, and then you, then it was you.
I was Schmidt.
You.
Yeah.
No, I'm at the end. Okay.
This meeting of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee will come to order. We have a lot of interesting presentations today. We don't quite have a quorum here. I think we're one person shy of it still, but I'd like to get going. And I know there's a number of meetings going on at the same time, and I apologize to that for our speakers and hope that committee members can get as much of this as we can. We'll start out by having the presentations, and then we will, for those members, those presenters who are able to stay around later in the hearing, we would like to have a chance to do more questions and answers. We won't say no questions right now, but I'd like to move as smoothly as we can through the presentations first. And so we'd like to start out with, I don't know if you're going to be as a panel, but Dr. Mark Seeley, Paul Douglas, and Dr. John Abraham. And we are still getting the PowerPoint together?
No, I think maybe what we'll do is, while you guys are working on that, do you mind? Okay. This is your computer.
Certainly.
We have a lot of expert witnesses today, and we're very much appreciative of your taking the time to come share with us.
Oh, I have it too.
Good afternoon.
Okay.
Are you getting visited by all the public?
Oh, yeah.
Do you want the you can use my remote.
Especially since I'm not. Okay. Nothing bills that lay their interim rating. I heard about machinery doesn't work.
The most powered company in my office.
I said, when you have to wax with their bill in the Senate, you just.
Thank you.
Sure. I'll tell you what the Minnesota Power just redid this.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and go ahead and please tell us which packets we're working off of.
Okay. Mark Seeley. I'm a professor in the Department of Soil, Water, and Climate at the University of Minnesota. I'm also extension climatologist. And I'm here today to talk about climate change in the context of Minnesota, what Minnesota data are showing us. In other words, what's happening in our own backyard. I'm representing also the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences Civic Engagement Committee today. Context, very briefly, is that I'm a traditionally trained meteorologist and climate scientist concerned with measurements. The measurement history of Minnesota is a very important to me, and those of you that have not read my book, the context for my remarks is from our weather history, which dates back to 1807. So I'll try to lay the groundwork for some of the remarks by the other speakers and maybe spend 10 to 12 minutes on this. I'm going to talk about perceptions of climate behavior related to our state's infrastructure, evidence of our vulnerability, some data trends in three specific climate parameters, character change in precipitation, extremes, and then consequences. Very important point to make for all of us as Minnesota citizens is that over the time since statehood, our infrastructure, the freshwater supply system, our electric utility grid, our interstate transportation system, our architecture, our public health, any number of the facets of our infrastructure that support our quality of life in this state are tailored to being effective given our climate history. We have a variety of ways of looking at that climate history. This slide, which was out of a paper, a very famous paper by Stan Chagnon back in the 1990s, gives four different views of climate behavior in a graphical sense. The stationary view is one that basically is based on the perspective that if we measure the climate at a point on Earth for a long enough period of years, we'll be able to adequately describe its central tendencies, its mean, modes, medians, etc., its annual variation, and its extremes. And in fact, this was a founding father's perception of climate behavior. Cyclical, I'm going to skip over because we don't deal much with cyclical perceptions of climate behavior in Minnesota. The third graphic down is the variability perception, which is a modification, if you will, of the stationary one that simply acknowledges in our mid-continent climate like we live in here in Minnesota, we have periods where our variability amplifies. Simply stated, one year is distinctly different than the next. And we also have periods in our history where our variability is suppressed, and in fact it appears as though the climate is stuck in a rut. One year behaves similar to the next. More pertinently, the fourth view or perception of climate change is this trend shift view, which acknowledges that if you perturb the climate in some way, simplest example might be to dam a river, take out a forest, take out a wetland, or do any number of other things, you're going to change the interaction with the atmosphere and you're going to change the climate attributes. What we're detecting in our Minnesota climate history is a trend shift view, so we're now measuring a population of climate measurements that are distinctly different than those we've measured in history. In that context, our infrastructure being tailored to maximize efficiency from the old climate history, we now need to adapt. Vulnerability is another feature of what climate offers here in terms of individual weather events or climate episodes. National statistics as well as Minnesota statistics suggest that we have not mitigated or dampened our vulnerability to individual weather events such as tornadoes, landfall, hurricanes, and things of that nature, or episodes of climate like drought and wildfires. In fact, quite the converse. The economic consequence of these events and episodes, at least in our data analysis, is getting worse across time. The three attributes of our climate that are changing in our region are temperature, notably getting warmer, with a seasonality character to it, as well as a diurnal character to it. Water vapor, our dew points, more frequent episodes of tropical-like dew points in Minnesota, which, of course, we all felt last July 4th, arguably one of the our hottest 4th of Julys in Minnesota history in 2012. And then the amplified moisture signal, which is an amplified variation in our precipitation and a higher contribution from thunderstorms. There's a graphic of our statewide database taken from the Minnesota State Climate Office, populated by all our weather observers in the state, well over 252 daily observers of temperature. You can see the slope across time back to the 19th century is an upward slope indicating warming. The slope of the blue line in only the last three decades is a steeper slope yet, suggesting that the trend has accelerated in this regard. The new normals, which were released last year by the National Climatic Data Center of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, all show clear positive change in the temperature measurements. I would invite you to go on our website and sample any community of interest to you. You will find the same change or level of change at most of them. The minimums have gone up, as you can see, by whole degrees. Down at Austin, Minnesota, you can see the minimum in January has changed by plus 3. The minimum in December has changed by plus 2.2. You can also see the persistence in the positive signal there in both the minimums and the maximum temperatures. There's another look at Wilmer, another site with the same consistency of change as well as the same amplitude of change. And the icebox of the nation, International Falls, sort of the test bed for cold weather manufacturers, is changing remarkably. And here, decade by decade, you can see how their minimums are changing. At the pace of change that's going on, for example, in the month of February, the average February minimum temperature in International Falls may one day not be below zero. So we see this progression of change going on in our data. In the water vapor signal, we see that the frequency that tropical-like air masses, those with dew points of 70 degrees or higher, visit our state is upward. The number of episodes is upward here in the Twin Cities, as illustrated in the top graph. The bottom bar graph illustrates that even episodic spells of such tropical weather are visiting Voyageurs National Park up on the Canadian border. For example, in July of 2012, our observers at Cabotogama reported an 80-degree dew point with a 112 heat index. That's in an area of the Minnesota landscape we commonly consider a respite from the summer heat. It also inflates the heat index, and so by law, the National Weather Service has to issue a heat advisory when the heat index is going to go to 105 or greater. That is, the combination of air temperature and water vapor in the atmosphere is going to exercise an effect on our bodies that is equivalent to 105 degree air temperature. We have had more episodes of this in recent summers, and furthermore, we've had these episodes driven by dew point rather than air temperature. In 2011, we had a heat index of 134 at Moorhead, Minnesota, at 4 p.m. in the afternoon. In fact, a little piece of trivia to share with your colleagues is that 4 p.m. in the afternoon on July 19th of 2011, Moorhead, Minnesota was the hottest point on planet Earth, even higher than Furnace Creek, Death Valley, because the combination of high water vapor and temperature there made it feel like 134 outside. We have had, well, over the course of our history, documentation of heat waves and their effect on the Minnesota landscape all the way back to 1883. The list I present to you is simply to show you the pattern across time is one that's episodic in nature, and that the red highlighted years are those where the heat wave was driven by dew point or water vapor in the atmosphere rather than purely air temperature. And you can see it's those recent years that have been triggered by water vapor rather than air temperature. Lastly, the moisture variation is depicted here in the graphic that shows in recent decades a number of those dots are beyond the 90th percentile historically, or 75th percentile, I beg your pardon, but nevertheless way up in terms of our precipitation. Overall, precipitation quantities at most Minnesota locations have risen across time. Illustrations of that are in the new normals that show, for example, a place like Wilmer in Candiohi County is now 28% wetter on average than they once were. A place like Brainerd up in the Lakes Vacation District of Minnesota is upward by 23% in precipitation over what they once were. And yet embedded in the quantity shift upward in precipitation is this impact of thunderstorms. National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration researchers have documented that the fraction of our precipitation on an annual basis that comes from thunderstorms is an increasing fraction. They contribute more substantially to our annual precipitation. As a result of that, the recurrence intervals for different levels of precipitation intensity, 2-inch rain, 3-inch rain, 4-inch rain, etc., are changing. And many, many examples in our state climate record illustrate this, that the frequency, for example, given in the table here of 2-inch thunderstorm rains is more pronounced in the last couple of decades than it was in the previous 100-plus years. And you can see also some of the extremes we've had. Lastly, our recurrence calculations for these intense rainfalls will be redistributed and released to us later in the year by the National Hydrologic Office. Everyone anxiously awaits those because those will give us a new basis to look at recurrence intervals for intense precipitation. Nevertheless, we acknowledge using the old statistics that since 2004, South Central and Southeastern Minnesota has had 3 1,000-year flash floods. All of these are quantified by our very dense precipitation network. We have over 1,500 observers in the state that document the level of intensity of these rainfalls, and they've all had rather dramatic consequence, I might add. With the character change in precipitation, though, we all find that we get areas in the state that are too much precipitation, areas in the state that are too little. As a result of that, that's the nature of thunderstorms. Thunderstorms they infer high spatial variability in their signature. So where they miss often gets zero or very little, and where they hit often gets too much. The chart here shows all years in state history that have been affected by drought, severe to extreme drought, and you'll note that we have had severe to extreme drought in Minnesota every summer since 2005. Not in the same position on the landscape, that's moved around quite markedly over the years, but nevertheless, it has surfaced on the landscape. In 2007, we had 24 counties designated by a Red X that were declared by USDA to be federal drought disasters. August of 2007, in the same month, we had 7 southeastern Minnesota counties designated by FEMA as federal flood disasters as the result of one of those 1,000-year rainfalls. We thought that was a singularity. I labeled it as such from a statistical standpoint back in 2007. It was a singularity to say that on the Minnesota landscape we had simultaneous drought and flood disasters declared. Last year no longer was a singularity. In 2012, it repeated itself. We had 55 Minnesota counties declared for federal drought disaster, and we also had all those counties with an X in it declared by FEMA as federal flood disasters. So with the character change in our precipitation signature, we may see a higher frequency of this polar opposite disaster declaration on our landscape. Consequence. We have seen consequence. We've seen consequence agriculturally in terms of longer growing seasons, changes in our plant hardiness zones, changes in the habit and character of our soil freezing, more rapid breakdown of our crop residues left on the agricultural landscape, more opportunities for invasive species, greater freeze-thaw cycles, more mold and allergen patient loads at our health facilities, more heat advisories. Now, these not only for our human population in Minnesota, but for our farmers who raise livestock. In fact, we've had devastating years on the livestock industry in this state in 1995, 1999, 2001, and 2006 as a result of these heat spells. And, of course, lots of work on flood mitigation and storm sewer runoff systems, compensating or mitigating, if you will, for this change in precipitation, and that work continues. And in my closing remark, I'd just like to salute all those Minnesota citizens that work in various groups to mitigate the effects we're seeing on the Minnesota landscape of these changing climate parameters. They are real. They are occurring. More importantly, they're occurring at a faster pace than we have detected in our measurement history. And with that, I'll hand it off to Paul Douglas. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Seely. Hi, everybody. I'm going to come at this from a slightly different angle. Dr. Mark Seely is the guru when it comes to climate and climate trends. I am a meteorologist. I'm a serial entrepreneur, a jobs creator. I am a lifelong Republican, an evangelical Christian who believes that the climate is in fact changing and that we are largely responsible, which makes me the equivalent of an albino unicorn. And don't I know it? I have the arrows in my back to prove it. And that's fine. We should also make note of the fact that this is the coldest day in 4 years. That point has not been lost on us. God has a good sense of humor. This is weather. Weather is CNN headline news. What we're talking about is the History Channel. I think it's baked into our DNA to look out the window and assume that this is the way it is everywhere. And I keep reminding people gently, the global, in the term global warming, it's hard even for television meteorologists to keep that global perspective. And yet, it's essential. I've started 9 Minnesota companies, and many of you are business owners, former business owners. You know that if you do not follow the data and react to trends, you quickly become roadkill. You go bankrupt. You have to lay off good people. And I've tried to apply this discipline to tracking the weather data points, not just what is the weather, but what does it mean? Where are we going? I did not invent Doppler radar. I did invent three-dimensional weather graphics, and we were the first company to put an app on a smartphone back in 2001. My fascination, my passion is the intersection of meteorology and technology. And I have to be honest, I was initially skeptical. And it's good to be skeptical. I tell people you should be skeptical. But persistent cynicism in the face of overwhelming evidence is probably ill-advised and not a great way to base policy. When Dr. James Hansen testified before NASA in 1988, we had a terrible heat wave and drought that year. And I thought, you know, maybe he's jumping the gun. I don't see it. And then in the 90s, here in Minnesota, I began to see these markers, these data points. I tell people it was as if Mother Nature picked up a remote control, put our seasons on fast forward, and turned the volume of extreme weather up to a 10. I was seeing it in day-to-day weather. This whole concept of normal weather had shifted. Of course, the weather's always been extreme. Of course, we've always had ups and downs, record highs and record lows. But the frequency and intensity of this volatility and these extremes had shifted, as Dr. Seely reported. This was no overnight epiphany. It had nothing to do with Al Gore. I've been tracking weather patterns for 40 years, and by the mid-90s, I noticed that something had changed. And then it got me thinking. Frankly, it got me diving into the peer-reviewed research. It's easier to get your climate information from a blog post, perhaps from cable television. But if you really want to know what's going on, you need to dig into the peer-reviewed science. And I asked myself, why doubt the climate scientists? What motive do they have to mislead on a global scale? Why would thousands of PhD climate scientists conspire to mislead a global population? And I don't know about you, I tend to be skeptical of conspiracy theories in general. Last year in the United States, the hottest year ever recorded, 3.2 degrees warmer than the 20th century average. Ninth warmest year overall. 7 of Minnesota's 10 warmest years have come since 1998. I'm all for cycles, but at some point you look at the data, you step back, and you say this is more than a natural cycle. And last year was truly off the charts, as much as 4 to 5 degrees warmer across much of the upper Midwest, some counties as much as 6 to 7 degrees warmer here in the upper Midwest. We've had 36 years in a row, 36 consecutive years, with global temperatures warmer than the 20th century average. This is data from NASA. 28 years here in the United States, but globally, you have to go way back 36 years to find a cooler than average year worldwide. Worldwide, 9 of the warmest years on record have been observed since 2000. The first decade of this century thought to be the warmest decade in 1,000 years. So again, there was no one event, no one storm, no one heat wave that got me to acknowledge the science. It was a steady drip, drip, what I call an accumulation of coincidences. We had record Arctic ice loss in September. It's now roughly 35% to 40% less in terms of aerial coverage and volume than it was 30 to 40 years ago. There's a lot of talk about those alarmist climate scientists. Here is the prediction of Arctic ice loss through the year 2100. Here's where we were in 2012. Some of these changes are happening much faster than even the most conservative climate scientists estimated. And ironically, the fact that we're losing Arctic ice may be contributing to more volatility. We're seeing something called polar amplification. If you warm up the Arctic, you decrease the temperature gradient over North America, which lightens the winds, which creates more of these dips and bulges, which means weather systems move slower. Weather gets stuck in a way that it didn't get stuck 30, 40 years ago, which allows heat waves and droughts to become deeper, storms to move slower, producing more precipitation, more flooding, and you wind up with freakish systems like Sandy. This is the Climate Extreme Index. This is a national measure of extreme wet conditions and extreme drought. And again, you look at the trends. The trends are certainly upward in recent decades. Poor Barry Bonds will probably best be remembered for the weather on steroids analogy. You cannot prove that any one of his 762 home runs was the result of steroid injections, but physicians will tell you that it did, in fact, influence his base state, his ability to whack one out of the park. So it is with weather. No single storm, no event can be pinned on a warming atmosphere. And yet, climate scientists warn that we are, in fact, loading the dice in favor of more of these extreme events. And amplifying something that Dr. Seely said, worldwide natural disasters have increased 3 to 4x since 1980. Weather on steroids is here. There are very few atheists in foxholes and very few agnostics, climate agnostics, in the insurance industry. As you will hear later on today, the number of billion-dollar weather disasters. Some of this is land use, more people retiring near the ocean, more people living in the floodplain, but superimposed on this, the trends are pretty harrowing. And in my 40 years, I've never seen a storm like Sandy. Sandy was a freakish combination of nor'easter and hurricane. It had a warm core. The fact that sea level has risen 5 to 7 inches conservatively in coastal New Jersey and metro New York contributed to the damage. And ocean water temperatures off New Jersey were typical of Jacksonville, Florida, in late October. We also had a blocking high over Greenland, which many climate scientists believe was the result of this record Arctic ice loss, a big warm bubble that should not have been there, which steered Sandy inland. 99% of the time, storms in this location are swept out to sea. This time, it didn't. It made that jog inland. Something that I've noticed in recent years, weather whiplash. 2011, we had a 7-month flood on the Missouri River. Last year, the worst drought nationwide since 1956. You can't predict from year to year what it's going to be. This is something of an oversimplification, but when you warm up the air, and most Minnesotans are just fine with a warming atmosphere, I should add. Problem is, when you warm the air, you increase the amount of water vapor, like a sponge. That sponge can hold more water, and it can unleash that water much more quickly. One-day precipitation trends, for every degree Celsius that you warm the atmosphere, you can expect 20% more rainfall. The number of 3-inch plus downpours over the upper Midwest have doubled since 1964. Of course, we had the Duluth rain event June of last year. 8 to 10 inches of rain in the North Woods, thought to be a 1 in 500-year flood. So here we go. 97% of peer-reviewed published climate scientists see a link between warming and greenhouse gas emissions, mostly fossil fuel emissions. If 97% of cardiologists gave you a specific diagnosis, most rational, logical, God-fearing people would listen to their cardiologist. And yet, because we all look out the window and experience weather, I think many of us believe that somehow we are experts on climate science. Again, I am not a climate scientist. I'm a meteorologist trying to connect the dots. Schopenhauer, all truth goes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed, then it's violently opposed. Finally, it's accepted as self-evident. We are just coming out of phase two, and hopefully, in the coming years, moving into phase three. For our kids, our grandkids, it will be self-evident. There's no debate. NOAA, NASA, every major national academy on the planet says that the climate is shifting and that the man-made component of that is the most significant component. Same with the insurance industry and the U.S. military. There's very little debate in the Department of Defense, but there's been a very successful effort to confuse the public, reminiscent of what some of these paid doctors, paid for hired doctors in the 1970s. You can't prove that Aunt Ethel smoking three packs a day of Camel, you can't prove that that triggered her lung cancer. At one point, we were having a debate in the 1970s about causality. There was a fair amount of disagreement in the early and mid-70s. Philip Morris trotted out these paid doctors, and it injected doubt and confusion. And that is an art form, and some practice that art form very well. And that's those same tactics are being used today. People say, well, there's been no warming since 1998. That meme is ridiculous. You can cherry pick anything you want. Pick the beginning date, the ending date. Here's the reality. And yet, skeptics, and there will always be skeptics, just like there will always be conspiracy theorists. Well, no, look at this. Look at the slope. Really? I sat across from one of my heroes, John McCain, in 2007. We were honoring Iraqi vets, and I challenged him on climate change. This was back when just about everybody acknowledged that we had a potential problem. And I said, could this be a natural cycle, Senator McCain? He looked at me. He rolled his eyes. He said, Paul, I just got back from the Yukon. The village elder presented me with a 4,000-year-old tomahawk that just melted out of the permafrost. The odds that this is a natural cycle, slim to nil. We have not invalidated winter. We will see cold fronts. We will see snow. We are tracking a subtle slow-motion transformation with global implications. You can't look out at your thermometer, but do look out at the new birds and flowers, the new shrubs, the things that are growing there that weren't growing there 40 years ago. Twin Cities Metro, much of southeastern Minnesota now in climate zone 5. And that is a recent occurrence. Everything is shifting northward by 150 to 200 miles. Lee Fralick from the U, from the Center for Hardwood Ecology, sent me this photo taken last year, March 27th, magnolia trees in full bloom, St. Paul campus of the University of Minnesota. And he said, Paul, this is a business as usual scenario for the year 2090, because I don't know what to make of this. So here we go. Winters, by and large, and there are exceptions. 96 was a tough winter. 2009 was a tough winter, but step back and look at the trends. Most of the winters are now shorter. Old man winter is losing some of his teeth. Fewer sub-zero nights. In fact, it was Mark Seely who said that since 2000, we've seen a 4x increase in midwinter rain and ice. And the snowfall is sporadic. Used to be it would snow in October and snow would stay on the ground through late March, early April. Now it's a roll of the dice. Heating degree data, the greater the number, the colder the weather, we see a steady decline in heating degree days. We are spending less money heating our homes and businesses. These are the coldest temperatures in the metro every winter dating back to 1963. We used to get down into the minus 20s and minus 30s fairly regularly. Look at the trend. Now maybe it gets down to minus 5, minus 10, minus 15. Again, nighttime lows warming at the rate of about 8.3 degrees Fahrenheit per century. This according to the Minnesota Climate Office. Average ice out dates. The ice is not staying on our lakes as long as it did 20, 30, 40 years ago. Look at the trends. Lake Superior warming 3.3 degrees during the summer between 79 and 2006. So it's something of a paradox. But as Mark said, the forecast calls for increasingly hot and dry with more extreme rainfall events. The rain is falling harder, but that's a problem because much of that rain is not soaking into the soil where we need it. It's not soaking into our aquifers. It's not helping our farmers. And the fact that we are warming means that we are evaporating more water from our lakes, keeping water in our lakes and in our topsoil and in our aquifers is going to be a big challenge here in the years and decades ahead. The latest climate assessment report, more frequent and intense Midwestern heat waves, degraded air and water quality, more intense rainstorms and floods, more stress on the Great Lakes. I have a hunch we will not be taking water for granted here in coming years and increased public health risks. I close with a couple of quotes. This is one that resonated with me. I'm proud of having been one of the first to recognize that states and the federal government have a duty to protect our natural resources from the damaging effects of pollution that can accompany industrial development. You know who said that? Ronald Reagan, 1984, July 19th. He recognized we have an obligation to the environment and future generations as well as business. My point as a serial entrepreneur and a would-be businessman is that we're going to have to figure this out. And the faster we get past denial and get to solutions, the better off we will all be. Because mitigating climate change, building a more resilient Minnesota, is going to require a level of innovation and reinvention that is going to propel this state and our nation into a new competitive paradigm. There's no debate about the science in China, ironically, or Europe. We have to get past denial. There are nearly 1,000 references in the Old Testament and the New Testament to caring for God's creation. In Luke 16:12, man has been appointed as a steward for the management of God's property. Ultimately, he will give account for his stewardship. We are accountable. Native Americans have a great proverb. We do not inherit the earth from our ancestors. We borrow it from our kids. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Douglas.
Chair and senators, thanks for the opportunity to talk today. I'm John Abraham. I'm a professor at the University of St. Thomas. Much of my research is in the area of clean and renewable energy generation and climate change. Specifically, I work on oceanography, monitoring the ocean's heating. I have no formal presentation. I'm going to do all of this off the cuff, spoken. It's going to be different from the two talks which you just heard, which were wonderful and illustrative and also detailed. I'm going to hit some high points that a climate scientist looks at, and I'll be happy to take questions on the science later on. First of all, you've heard that scientists are really certain. I mean, 97% of the most active climate scientists agree. Why? Why do we know? Why have we known since the 1800s? Yes, that's when the first predictions of human-caused warming began. 1800s. Why do we know? It's not just that the Earth is warming. It's not just that our climate's changing. It's changing in the right way. These are called fingerprints. The fingerprints, the patterns of climate change tell us conclusively it's human caused. Let me give you an example. Many people say, well, the sun. John, the sun's getting hotter. That's what's causing it. It's not these greenhouse gases. If that were true, you'd expect days to be warming more than nights. We've observed the opposite. We've observed nights to be warming more. We're observing the poles, the North and South Pole, to be warming faster than the equatorial region. That's not consistent with a hotter sun. Finally, if the sun were getting hotter, we would expect the entire atmosphere to be getting warmer. We're not observing that. We're observing the bottom part of the atmosphere warming, the top part cooling down, because we're holding the heat down. So it's the pattern that tells us it's not the sun. And similarly, other patterns conclusively tell us that the warming is due to greenhouse gases.
I've read it.
I measure ocean heating. 90% of the heat is going, extra heat's going into the oceans. Ocean water can hold a lot of heat. The oceans are taking up so much CO2 because of human emissions that the pH has changed. The oceans are becoming more acidic, less alkaline, if you want to be technically accurate. Why do we care? Well, we care if we eat seafood, because changing pH of the ocean affects creatures that form calcium carbonate shells, the base of the food chain. The changing pH is another symbol, signifier that it's humans. We also have measurements from satellites, measurements from weather balloons, and all kinds of measurements around the world. They're all telling a consistent story. Human emissions are causing the Earth to warm. So what? You've heard talk about changes to Minnesota weather. Let me just be global and brief. Here's what we expect. In areas that are currently dry, they're going to become drier. In areas that are currently wet, they will become wetter, and the precipitation will happen in heavier downbursts. So what does that mean for the U.S.? The southwestern one-third of the U.S. we expect to be coming to get drier. We're seeing that. The drought and heat wave in Texas and Oklahoma in 2011 cost just Texas $5.2 billion. If you're a working Texan, it was $500 out of your paycheck. The drought last year around this country is estimated to have cost our country between 0.5 and 1% GDP. These are big and real costs. It's not just the United States. In Australia, they've had to put a new hot color on their temperature map because it's so hot right now. I had the good fortune of adopting a young girl from Uganda last year, and while I was traveling there, much of our work was with power generation in remote areas of Uganda. The farmers in Eastern Africa are already feeling this. This is already being felt around the world. So heat waves will become more intense. Hurricanes. The verdict on hurricanes is they're likely not going to be more hurricanes, but the powerful ones will be more powerful. In fact, we can quantify it. Let's take Sandy. How was Sandy impacted by human emissions? You've heard some discussion of that. I'm just going to go into a bit more detail. The crazy path Sandy took to come back to the East Coast was likely impacted by human-caused emissions. The precipitation was about 12% higher because of greenhouse gas warming. It went further north than it would have gone because of the warm ocean waters. And the sea level rise was about 8 to 10 inches higher because of human emissions. We can quantify this stuff. I'm going to close with just two really important ideas. One, carbon dioxide and greenhouse gas emissions are like no other pollution problem we've had. In the past, with smog, acid rain, we could just stop the source and the things would clear up quickly. It's not the case with carbon dioxide, where these molecules stay in the atmosphere tens or hundreds of years. Time matters. The Earth is like a freight train. It's got a lot of what's called inertia. You can't just take your foot off the accelerator and turn things around. Time matters. It matters a lot. The second thing, and this is what I want you to leave you with, there are four key ideas. If there's nothing else you take away from what I say, these are the key ideas. We know, scientists know, we've known it for over 150 years. We're not debating this any longer. But, number two, we can solve it. We can solve it with today's technology. We don't need cold fusion. We can solve it today. About 20% of emissions are due to deforestation. We can plant trees. We know how to do that. We can solve it today. If we solve it using smart choices, we can save money. We can create jobs. We can diversify our energy supply. We can improve national security. I drive through Windham, Minnesota often. Wind turbines, as far as the eye can see. Farmers being paid thousands of dollars per year for those turbines. Service, manufacturing, installation jobs here in Minnesota. I would rather be sending money to a farmer in southern Minnesota for wind power than to pay to keep shipping lanes in the Mideast open. These choices just make economic sense, even if you don't agree with climate change. And the last note, doing nothing is a choice. It is a costly choice. I'm a bit of a fiscal conservative. If someone were to tell me doing nothing but adapting was cheaper and easier, I'd say let's do nothing but adapt. But I am convinced that it is costlier to do nothing. It is cheaper to take action now to mitigate than to adapt. Doing nothing is a choice that has tremendous economic consequences, and that concludes my prepared or semi-prepared remarks. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Senator Dibble, a quick question.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. What is your pleasure?
I wanted to go, well, if you have a brief question, why don't we take that now?
But, not brief, so.
Are you three able to stay around for a little while? Then we can have a few other presentations and then open it up for questions?
Yes.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your presentations. Then we will continue with Dr. Peter Reich.
Mr. Chair, while she's finding that, I'll introduce myself. I'm Peter Reich. I'm a professor at the Department of Forest Resources at the University of Minnesota. It might be a little while, I guess, here. Okay. And it was instructive and sobering to hear the last three talks, because I think they set the stage very well for the next series of talks that we'll have here. And I'm not sure whether she wants me to monkey around with the computer or...
We do have your PowerPoint if you want to just go through it without that. Do you have a copy of your PowerPoint?
I think over here, just a sec.
Get you one, too. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you for the opportunity to come and chat with you a little bit about the challenges facing Minnesota's forests in the coming decades. And although I'm talking about forests, I think we could be talking about lots of other aspects of the Minnesota's natural and built environment, infrastructure, agriculture, many other things that would resonate with some of the things you'll hear today about the way in which a changing climate is likely to give us lots of problems as we move forward in the future. I included a quote from the president's inaugural speech yesterday because he reminded us of the fact that seemingly the nation has rediscovered the fact that the climate is changing and is starting to think about this, and I think this is none too soon. So I think it's very timely for us to be here today talking about it when he spoke yesterday about the importance of recognizing the way in which the climate was changing and the impacts of this through fires, drought, and many other effects, and that we need to do something about this for future generations. Now, although what I'm going to share with you today are my own opinions and thoughts, they're entirely consistent with the consensus view of an assessment advisory panel that was pulled together by the Minnesota Forest Resources Council this last year. The Minnesota Forest Resources Council is a stakeholder group. It includes representatives of environmental groups, forest industry, academia, county, state, and federal forestry agencies. And across that spectrum, there was consensus about the way in which climate was changing and the challenges it would bring to forests in the coming decades, as well as the other challenges forests will face. So what you're hearing today is not just the opinion of one university scientist, but really the consensus view of the entire forestry community. Well, where are our forests? Just a brief reminder of where we're coming from. There's a map there showing towns and cities around the state and a bunch of trees on streets and cities and in parks. Because regardless of where we live, whether we're on farms or in small towns, villages, or in big cities, we usually live in and among trees. We plant trees, we build in trees. And so this so-called urban forest, whether it's in a small town or a city, surrounds us where we live. And those are very important for the amenities they bring in our urban areas, cooling in the summer, stormwater regulation, and many other things. So we don't want to forget about them and what's going to happen to them. But more broadly across the state, we know that the forests are located mostly in the northeast. The further towards the Arrowhead you get, the denser and the thicker the forests. However, at least half the state has significant cover of forests, so forests are a pretty big deal for much of the state. Another piece of background information is just to remind us to think about the age of our forests. If our human population, everyone in Minnesota was 10 years old or 90 years old, that probably wouldn't be really a good mix of ages for carrying on economics and education and everything else. Well, it'd be the same thing for our forests. But luckily, actually, our forests are relatively all aged. We have roughly the same amount of 10-year-old, 30-year-old, 50-year-old, 70-year-old, and 90-year-old forests. Now, depending on where you are in the environment industry spectrum, some folks might like the forest to be a bit older or some a bit younger, but my opinion is that actually we're in a pretty good shape with respect to the distribution of forest ages at this point in time. The other thing I want to leave us with before I talk about the challenges is just to give us a frame of what's happening to our forests. If you asked 100 Minnesotans how much forest was being harvested every year, you'd probably get a huge range of responses. It's about 1%. It's 134,000 acres. That actually represents 0.9%, and it's gone down considerably since about a dozen years ago. So just keep that in mind. About one out of every 100 acres gets harvested every year. Let's move on to the challenges. I'm going to talk about four main challenges to our forests. The first one is climate change itself. The second are forest health threats, basically the vigor and productivity and sustainability of individual trees, which are influenced by disease and pests and other things, as well as by climate. The third issue involves forest fragmentation and parcelization. And the fourth, changes in biodiversity and wildlife habitat. Now, I want to remind us before I go on to talk about each of those in a little bit more detail. Of why we care about forests in the first place, other than the fact that they're beautiful, magnificent, and iconic in this part of the world. They, of course, are really important economically for fiber and other products. They're important as a recreation resource. They're important as habitat for biodiversity. They're important for climate regulation and for carbon sequestration, among other things. So they're very important to us in Minnesota as well as around the rest of the world. So I'm going to talk about these four elements. The first one is climate change. Well, you've heard a lot about how the climate will change and is changing. And just as there's no doubt about the direction that the climate's going, there's no doubt that climate change will affect the structure, function, and biodiversity of our forested ecosystems. The question is how fast and how much. So the forests will change. And as these forests change, it will affect the watersheds, the storage flow and quality of water coming out off of our forested landscapes. And of course, if you're changing the growth and health of forests and the water that are coming from forests and staying in forests, this will influence the human communities that are dependent on local forests. So climate change is going to impact these in a number of ways. The next item was forest health threats. As I mentioned, the health of forests, how fast they grow, how diseased they are, how long they live, is influenced by a number of things outside of climate change, of course. Pest diseases, natural fire, natural windstorms, insects, even in a non-climate change scenario. But climate change will influence all of those as well, making them more frequent and worse. So forest health will be influenced by all of these collectively. So the question we have and the challenge we face is, how do we sustain diversity and the functioning of these forested ecosystems in the face of invasives, of pests, and climate change? The third point of forest change I wanted to talk about was forest fragmentation, parcelization, and development. And here I'm going to talk about impacts both in the rural landscape and in the urban areas. Well, during the Great Recession, development slowed down but didn't stop, but it'll pick up again. And over the past decades and in the coming decades, we're going to build more and more second homes, vacation homes, and everyday homes out as far out at the end of those dirt roads as we can get out into the lakes and woods and streams, because we like being there. And so this parcelization, and additionally, the large holdings are being broken up and sold to smaller developers. So we have the landscape in which more and more people are going to be scattered in and amongst the forest, and that has impacts directly on wildlife and forest, but also has indirect impacts because of the constraints it places on the ability of managers to manage in the face of humans being cheek to jowl with wildlife and with forests that might burn, and also causes barriers to migration. Fragmentation, parcelization, development also has impacts in urban areas. Basically, if we're not planting trees, if wind blows down trees, or if exotic pests kill trees, we can lose tree cover, and that's an important issue. Gary Johnson, the urban forester at the U, estimates that across the state our urban forests have about 25% cover. They should actually have about 40% cover to maximize benefits for stormwater regulation and shading and cooling in the summer. So we're lacking a lot of tree cover in our urban ecosystems. And so as we develop, and if we lose trees and don't replace them, that's a problem as well. The last of the issues is biodiversity and wildlife. We know there's risks to biodiversity from climate change itself, from harvest, from parcelization, from changing in the health of the forest. The moose is the poster child for biodiversity risk. Moose simply aren't built to withstand warm temperatures. Our air and water is warming up. Moose are in the decline. It's impossible to see how that decline will not continue in the decades to come. But many other organisms, plants, animals, and others have problems as well. So again, the issue is, what management strategies mitigate negative changes or promote adaptation and resilience? So we need to be smarter about how we're managing our landscape for a wildlife and biodiversity in general. This slide for me kind of summarizes those past few slides, because I put the iconic picture of the Arrowhead Northeast lakes and forests up in the upper left and have arrows to three alternative scenarios with question marks, because we're relatively sure that the forests are going to change, but we don't really know what they're going to change to, in part because we don't know exactly how climate's going to change, and in part, even given knowledge about climate change, it's hard to say exactly how forests will change. So in the lower left, I show a picture of an oak savanna which once covered big chunks of the central part of the state. If it gets warmer and drier in the north, we could have climate that's conducive to the kind of savannas and oak woodlands we used to see throughout the center part of the state in pre-settlement. If it gets warmer and wetter and we don't have big droughts between those big rain events, we might get forests like exist in northern Wisconsin, the oak, maple, hardwoods shown in the bottom right. However, the pace of climate change is fast enough, it will be very difficult for the oaks or maples from either savannas or forests to move north fast enough to replace those northern trees if they start to die en masse in 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 years. And there's also towns, cities, highways in the way that prevent migration from occurring very rapidly. So maybe we'll get something like we show in the upper right-hand corner, which is a vine-covered scrub, where we have scrubby vegetation that's neither economically nor ecologically useful or advantageous, but we get that because the existing forest starts to fail and it can't be replaced by a useful forest in a short time period. Which of these arrows are our forest really going to go in? Well, probably some of all, depending on where in the landscape you are and depending where in this time horizon we're looking at. A couple points I want to make to follow up on what Mark and Paul made earlier is that climate change is extremes. It's not just that it's going to be a little warmer on average. And this is really important for ecosystems, including forests. There'll be more heat waves, more floods, more droughts. The rainfall may be average, but we'll have more floods and more droughts despite that. And this will bring along with it increasing frequency of severe events from the standpoint of the forest. More thunderstorms, more tornadoes, more wildfires. This is a series of pictures from before and after the famous July 4th, 1999 blowdown, just to remind us of what a landscape that has a major windstorm that's gone through it would look like. We'll see more of these in the future. We also see invasive species, which I haven't talked about before, because even without climate change, we would have invasive species. Here are three of them that are having big impacts on forests. The emerald ash borer, which will probably kill 98% of the ash trees in this state, both in the cities and in the forests, in the next 20, 40, 60 years. We've got buckthorn, which prevents regeneration of forest trees already in much of the eastern and southern part of the state. And we've got exotic earthworms, which are eating away at the forest floor and preventing recruitment of tree species as well. Now, there is a climate change angle to this as well, because all three of these and many other invasive species were previously restricted to how far north they went because it was too cold. As the winter is shorter and the coldest days of winter aren't as cold and don't kill as many of these overwintering creatures, invasive species are moving north and doing better further north. So there's a synergy, if you will, a bad one from our standpoint, between invasive species and climate change. Native insects can also cause a lot of forest damage as well. Here's an example of benign native insects from British Columbia, the mountain pine beetle, which previously didn't do much damage. But because of climate change, allowing the growing season to go longer so the population could grow, and with warmer winters that don't kill a lot of them in the winter, they increased their populations exponentially and caused millions and millions of acres of tree mortality in lodgepole pine. And believe me, those forests can then burn very easily. The mountain pine beetle is actually starting to switch from lodgepole pine to jack pine, which is in Minnesota and is a very closely related species. Whether and when it will get here, we're not sure. But there are many other native insects that could become more serious pests in a changing climate. Now, all of these last things I've talked about can influence fire. Trees blow down, if insects kill them, if it's hot, if it's dry, if it's windy, those are all conducive to fires and fire spread. Now, our northern pine and spruce forests and aspen and birch forests, fire was part of that landscape, but just like Goldilocks, we need to have the fire regime just right for our forests to be healthy. If we have too little fire or too much fire, that could be very bad from a human standpoint. And given that we don't control the climate today, or we control it unintentionally, and that we don't control windstorms, we don't control insect pests, we don't really know what's going to happen to the fire regime. And given that people are living closer and closer to the forest, this is a major management problem as well as an ecological problem. So if I'm going to pull this all together with some conclusions, when we think of our northern pine, aspen, spruce forests, these are projected to do poorly with climate change. So there is a serious risk of forest decline due to collapse of these boreal species. Will it happen in 10 years, 5 years, 40 years, 80 years? That's what we don't know, because we don't know how fast it's warming and how many droughts we'll have during those warming periods. Now, the central oak maples that exist in the Hardwood Forest to the south of that boreal forest, Those will expand north, but natural migration will not keep pace with climate change. So there's no perfect solution to those northern forests. Additionally, these oaks and maples that grow in central Minnesota and over in Wisconsin, they will become stressed in their current range because of climate change, drought, insects, and other problems. So there's a lot we need to worry about and think about. There is one strategy that can help a little bit, and that's to think about encouraging more climate-robust species. When we're dealing with forests, we're not just planning for 2 years from now. We're planning for 10, 20, 50, 100 years from now. And as we either plant or manage naturally regenerated forests, we need to think about encouraging species that will be climate-robust. They could be local, or they could be from neighboring systems a little further south or east of where we traditionally think of our trees coming from. And that may be necessary to maintain healthy forests. So that's, when I have my forestry hat on, that's important. But that simply is not enough. The question at this pivotal moment is, how much do we truly care about Minnesota's forests and ecosystems? We're going to sit and watch over the coming decades as they decline right before our very eyes? Or do we, as caring and responsible Minnesotans, take action to cut our greenhouse gas emissions? Minnesota has a history of being a leader. Maybe that history has been in abeyance for the last couple of decades. We can be a leader again within the country to start to make changes. I think it's very important to remember that climate adaptation, whether in forests or for infrastructure of highways or anything else, is only a Band-Aid. Only by slowing down, stopping, and eventually reversing climate change are we ever going to get out of this mess. And it's time for us to work all together to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Reich. Bob, if you're ready now, please come up. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. If you'll take your handout, I don't have any slide or overhead here that I'm going to work with. Just take a couple of minutes, hear from the scientists, and give you a little bit of insurance data and statistics. So, Mr. Chairman, the handout at the top, it says Insurance Information Institute, and really what this
it's
is.
Being distributed as you start. They're distributing it right now. So
I'll wait, because this will only take a couple of minutes once I start. So, Mr. Chairman and committee members, what you have in front of you, or will have in a second, it's Insurance Information Institute is what says at the top of it. What this is just some very brief excerpts out of a presentation from an insurance industry educational summit that we put on about a year ago. And this is data that was pulled together by Dr. Bob Hartwig. He's the president of the Insurance Information Institute, and he's one of the leading national voices for property casualty insurers operating in Minnesota and around the country. And I think, as you can tell by the title, what in the world is going on? Is the world, including Minnesota, becoming a riskier place, and what are the implications for the insurance industry? The purpose of the program, Mr. Chairman and committee members, was really for education, not only of insurance companies, but agents and brokers operating in this state, because of the significant changes that we as an industry have seen in terms of severe storms in Minnesota, and obviously its impact on Minnesota consumers and the primarily homeowners insurance that they're buying. I think if you turn to the next page, again, these are excerpts out of a much longer presentation, but I wanted to highlight it for purposes of the committee today, Mr. Chairman, and there can be, I'm pretty sure this presentation is fully on the III website if the committee members wanted to see all of the data there, but the next two slides show what probably most folks aren't familiar with or aware of, is that we think of the coastal states as being hurricane states and severe weather states with catastrophes, and yet Minnesota in the years 2007 and 2008. As you can see, in 2007, we were the second highest of all 50 states with catastrophe losses. Catastrophe is an event, definition-wise, which generates $25 million in insured losses. And so we hit, 700-some million in 2007, $1.5 billion in catastrophe losses in 2008. And I can tell the committee members that a lot of that is hail claims on roofs and roofs being replaced in Minnesota. And so with that brief commentary in terms of catastrophe losses, and as the next slide says, we may not be a coastal state, but we're no stranger to catastrophes. And I'll just briefly, Mr. Chairman, again, the presentation goes through historical trends, and you had experts here on your first panel that gave far more details in terms of the changing weather patterns. We clearly see that. I think we just put one of the slides in here from NOAA on the number of tornadoes per year. You can see the numbers there for Minnesota, and we put a slide in there, the next one on just severe weather. This program was done in the fall of 2011. So we wanted to, and the slide presentation gives some trending of the changes over time also, which I didn't incorporate in the handouts here. Some data that I don't have right now in the packet, but we'll just give to the committee. Again, it helps put some perspective on this. In the last 5 years in Minnesota, about two-thirds, about 67% of all property claims in Minnesota are from wind and hail. So it's a significant number of claims are wind and hail. The next most common type of claim is water damage. That only accounted for 12%. Over that same five-year period of time, 57% of all homeowner claims in Minnesota were from catastrophes. So I gave that definition of catastrophe. It's interesting, and we'll follow up this presentation, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like some more of this data in writing, because some of this I was just able to pull together this morning. 57% of all homeowners' claims over the last five-year period are catastrophes compared to Wisconsin. Wisconsin was 38% of their homeowner claims. Iowa was 39%. So there's some interesting state variations in what the data is showing. Similarly, in terms of those catastrophe losses, for every $100 in insured catastrophe losses in Iowa, there were $248 in insured catastrophe losses in Minnesota. For every 100 insured catastrophe losses in Wisconsin, there were 331 paid in Minnesota. So at least a picture over the last 5 years on a regional basis of some of the differences that we're seeing. And I think the last few slides, Mr. Chairman, that I'll conclude is at least to give the committee, and I know this is probably Commerce Committee jurisdiction, a number of these issues, but that translates into the numbers is affecting the insurance industry, the pricing, the marketing of the product. The next slide that is in your handout, we've got one on the homeowner's loss ratio, and loss ratio is just the phrase that's used to describe out of each dollar in premium that an insurance company collects, how much is paid out in losses. As you can see, there are years where the loss ratio is well in excess of 100, which means that more than a dollar was paid out for each dollar, and that's just in claims, not any of the insurance company kind of expenses, overhead, agent costs. So the changing pattern has clearly produced some instability in that sense within the industry, but it's also produced in the next two slides handouts there show the significant growth within Minnesota in terms of all of this is translating to consumers and the premiums that they're paying. And you can see the growth and that average homeowner expenditure percentage-wise. And we also have one of the homeowners, the average expenditure by state for 2008. And Minnesota is now in the top 15 states for the average annual premium. The last page on your packet kind of translates it all because this shows the consumer impact. That over the 10-year period, 1997 to 2010, the percentage increase for homeowners' average of premiums has been 267%. The nationwide average over that same period of time is 199%. I suspect that everyone in this room could give their own story about the growth of their homeowners premiums in the last decades. It has been significant. So we've gone from 35th a decade ago to 14th. This data is a little bit dated in the sense that we don't see it 2011 and 2012 on there. I don't expect this to get any better in 2011 and 12. There's some lag in the reporting of the data, but the last few years have similarly seen some severe weather-related losses. And with that, Mr. Chairman, again, it's kind of a snippet of information. I'm glad to see that you have on the agenda, I believe, at your next hearing. The Commerce Department, obviously, all licensed insurers report comprehensive data to the department, so they have an even kind of greater compilation of data statistics that I'm sure would bear that out. But at least for today, Mr. Chairman, I hope that gives you and the committee members some picture of the impact on claims and consumers of kind of the changing weather patterns.
Thank you. And real quickly, when you meet with the industry folks and they make these presentations, the trend obviously is, do they talk about what they project in 3, 4, or 5 years from now, or that's an every year kind of thing?
Mr. Chairman, it really is a year by year. I think as you saw in there, the trend is very clear. There was, I think, 1 year in the last 8 where we had a kind of a moderation down in the weather. But the long-term trend has been strong. But that's really all we can do as an industry, look at the past year, look at what the losses are, project for the next year. And so we don't do pricing looking out 5 years or 10 years. We really do it for the immediate year ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much. Ms. Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. My name is J. Drake Hamilton. I serve as Science Policy Director for the private nonprofit organization Fresh Energy, which is a 22-year-old Minnesota-based company that was formed to provide market-friendly solutions so that in Minnesota we can move beyond the fossil fuels, of which we have none, to the clean energy and energy efficiency solutions that Minnesota entrepreneurs and innovators are so good at doing to get multiple competitors to bring us more clean energy in Minnesota. I'm going to be speaking today to this handout that's just a one-pager, so you can find that, committee members can find it in their packet. It's two-sided, looks like this. I've been asked to talk about the public interest in Minnesota in action on climate change, and I want to just recap what we've heard from the scientists and engineers who've come before me, that this is a problem that is largely human-caused, that it is a problem in many ways for the economy of Minnesota, for our pocketbooks, for the natural resources of Minnesota, and the natural resources-based economies of Minnesota, like forestry and agriculture. We've heard that in spades, I think, today. And that's something that we have decisions to make about what to do. But we have also found that there is strong support for action in all areas of Minnesota. I want to give you two snapshots of that. First of all, I often work with a group called the National Wildlife Federation, which has thousands of members in Minnesota. And these are outdoors people. They hunt, they fish, they spend time camping outdoors, and they are recognizing the changes that they're seeing. The National Wildlife Federation did a random survey of people who hunt and fish among their members. They conducted it between August 23rd and September 1st of 2012, and they released the report. I first saw it in Field & Stream magazine on September 25th. The article is called "New Poll Shows Most Sportsmen Tend to Be Environmentally Minded Conservatives." And so the polling group, 42% of those, and this is indicative of the membership of NWF, 42% Republican, 32% Independent, 18% Democrat. And they tend to be conservatives who support environmental protection. The findings of the poll include the following. 66% of hunters and anglers think global warming is currently occurring, and they believe that we have a moral responsibility to confront global warming to protect our children's future. Additionally, 69% of the hunters and fishermen agree that the U.S. should reduce its carbon emissions that contribute to global warming and threaten fish and wildlife habitats. And third result, sportsmen overwhelmingly believe that the economy is strengthened by investing in renewable energy technologies that create jobs and reduce global warming pollution. I think this poll indicates that these are not partisan issues. They're issues of concern for anyone who is interested in the outdoor life and outdoor spaces in Minnesota and the health and happiness of the next generation. Secondly, I want to point you to the series of 8 public forums that Fresh Energy and the Will Steger Foundation conducted over 1 month this fall in more mainstream, more conservative areas outside of the Twin Cities in Minnesota. And what we were attempting to do is to let Minnesotans know about the good bipartisan policies that have been supported by past legislators and past governors of the state, especially the 2007 laws that were passed, the Renewable Energy Standard and the Next Generation Energy Act, that call for big increases in the market for renewable energy, and in the case of the Next Generation Act, set energy savings goals for our natural gas and electric utilities, and in addition, set for the first time science-based global warming pollution reduction goals for the state. So we talked about those, and in every case, we had a free public forum open to everyone, and we had, I'll give you some of the numbers as I run down on the back side of the list where we were. I want to start by saying who our partners were, because it would have been impossible to have a genuine public forum unless we had significant local partnerships. So our partners included the League of Women Voters of the Brainerd Lakes area, the Northwestern Synod of the ELCA in Minnesota, the Southwestern Synod of the ELCA in Minnesota, and the Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy in Minnesota. And that set of partners allowed us to have bishops speak at many of these forums. The New Ulm Citizens for Clean Energy, CURE, the Winona State University Department of Geoscience, the President's Office at Concordia College in Moorhead, Restoring Eden, which is Evangelical Christians Concerned About Climate Change, Northwestern College, Rochester Public Schools Community Education, the Bethel University Department of Environmental Studies, and the Bethel University Creation Restoration Club. If you look on the opposite side, you'll see our 8 forums. We were in Baxter speaking to 200 people, in New Ulm at a Lutheran church to 240 people. For Winona State, I have a more exact number because we ran out of chairs and the facilities department had to bring in an additional 75 chairs. So we know exactly that was 264 people in that auditorium. At Concordia College Moorhead, perhaps because they knew that the year before on July 19th, I think Dr. Seeley said, they had the hottest day on Earth. We had 300 people at Concordia College in Moorhead. At John Marshall High School in Rochester, 250. 240 people at Bethlehem Lutheran Church in St. Cloud. In Wilmer, we had our largest public forum, 400 people. And then finally at Northwestern College in Bethel University, that was during that big snowstorm on December 9th. I was actually actively advising my members not to come, which is against my grain, but I wanted everyone to be safe. But we had 65 students who were resident in the dormitories there and actively participated in the forums. What I want to say is what we got out of those forums. During the Q&A period, we heard excellent questions from people in the community. And people in the community, I'm talking about students at the universities. I'm talking about parents and grandparents. Active sportsmen, active retirees, mayors, city council members, small business people, large business people. And what those folks were saying is 3 things. That Minnesotans accept responsibility. Many of the questions were about what to do next, about responsibility. And many people were saying we can't ignore the growing reality of extreme and expensive weather. We owe it to our kids to protect them, and that means addressing climate change now. Many of the questioners spoke about accountability. They said, well, now that we know where the industrial carbon is coming from, we need to track our progress in slowly moving away from those fossil fuels and moving to growing the clean energy sector. We can build a secure, affordable energy future and address climate disruption, particularly if we use the 3rd point that people brought up at every forum, that they believe in American ingenuity, and particularly in those border towns, people were talking about Minnesota ingenuity. So we were on the border of North Dakota, and we were on the border of Wisconsin, and we were on the border of Iowa with various forums. And people loved the fact that Minnesota is now number 4 in the country in the percentage of wind electricity in our electricity forum. They did not know that before, by and large. And they want Minnesota to climb up to the top in all areas of clean energy going forward. Perhaps most striking, one of the best questions we got, I thought, happened to be from a young student at Concordia College Moorhead, who was asked the question, in St. Paul, when policymakers are working toward consensus and giving things up as they move toward enacting policies, how do they keep their eye on the prize? How do they keep their eye on the prize of how much carbon reduction we need to remove these climate disruptions that are damaging our future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Mr. Steger, I think I saw you enter the room. Welcome to the committee.
I want to thank the committee for offering me the opportunity to speak today. I represent the Will Steger Foundation. We work in three areas, K-12 curriculum, youth activism around climate policy, and we have a panel here, Climate Literacy. That's what I would recommend if you had a chance to read it. Am I okay? Yeah, great. I've been the eyewitness for global warming for a number of years. I think a number of you have attended maybe one or two of my presentations, but I wanted to go over just briefly a few pictures here. Let's see if I get this down. There we go, just a couple. I'm not going to bore you with too many charts or slides, but there's a couple here that are important. This one shows at the bottom here, we go over in years, 0 to 400,000 years. This was taken from an ice core in the eastern Greenland ice cap, and it shows the fluctuation of carbon dioxide over the last couple hundred thousand or 400,000 years. And what we see here, it fluctuates between 280 parts per million at a maximum and down to about 180. So we have this natural variation, which is caused by mainly the Earth's orbit, variations in the orbit. It's the Earth's orbit, first of all, is elliptical. So like every 110,000 years, it's closer to the sun. There's variations. There's a wobble in the axes of the Earth where we sometimes lean towards the sun, sometimes lean away. And of course, CO2 mirrors the temperature. We see the natural variation, ice ages, top of the ice ages, warmer ages here, and these lower areas here, 180 parts per million, we'd have maybe a kilometer or two, maybe a mile thick of ice over us in Minnesota. And then the point what I wanted to show you here is this rapid rise of carbon dioxide that occurred first at the beginning of the industrial age, which is going faster and faster up. It's up at 394 right at this level right now. I wanted to show you this because it shows the difference between this cycle has been going on for about 20 million years, pretty much like this, and suddenly we have this rise of CO2. This rise of CO2 mainly is from the burning of fossil fuels. In fact, the fossil fuels, when you burn it, has a certain type of fingerprint on the CO2, so we know where that rise is coming. The second part that I wanted to show you here, this is a little more of a magnification from 1960 up to current here. We see the slow range here. And at 350 parts per million, which we reached in 1990, this is what most scientists agreed is when 350 parts per million is when the ice on the globe started to melt. You often hear this 350.org. This is about the 1990 when we reached that level where the ice started melting. This is what most scientists consider the danger area, because once the ice starts melting, which I'm going to show you in a second, it changes the reflectability of some of the surfaces of the land. And then, of course, we've marched up almost to 400, so we're nowhere near bringing this down. This is a very danger point here that as quickly as we can to bring that down, which doesn't appear like it's going to happen anytime quickly here. This is the top of the globe here, the Arctic Ocean. North Pole would be right here. This is the size of the United States and Mexico combined. It's a very deep ocean, 15,000 feet at the North Pole. That ice is in constant movement, driven mostly by the wind. When you're camping on it, you're moving 3 to 8 miles a day, sometimes 15, 20 in a storm. Now, the importance of this ice is that it's reflected in the past. It's reflected the majority of the sun in the polar summer. The polar summer consists of 5 months of 24-hour light. So in other words, the sun is above the surface for 5 months. That energy is striking the ice, and then majority of that energy used to reflect back into outer space, which enabled us to keep the top of the globe here cool, which balanced the rest of the globe. We have an excess amount of heat in the equator. It would balance the globe with ocean currents and weather currents that we do have. And in 2006, we had a big breakup of this polar ice. 50% of that broke up during the summer. Last summer, two-thirds of it went. So this is having, I think I explained it here. This is what's happening. This would have been 25 years ago, normal year, reflective. This would have been in the 90s with warming temperatures, warming ocean. We start getting a little bit of open water, which is a darker surface. And the more open water, the more heat that absorbed. It's a domino effect. This was in 2007. We're nearing this point now. Some scientists say within the decade, I think most of us here are going to live to see it, where the Arctic Ocean opens up totally in the summer period. And this is a very serious thing because for the first time, actually in 07, for the first time, the Earth started to absorb more energy than we're giving out. So with the opening of ice here, this is the 07 here. This is the Arctic Ocean. This normally is all covered with ice. 10 years ago, it would have been up to the coastline here in the summertime, but we had this large breakup right here. This ice also, not only are we losing area of that, we're losing the volume of it because it's getting thinner and thinner, the ocean here. And then on the Greenland ice cap, this is Greenland. Greenland is the second to the largest ice cap in the world, 1,600 miles across. Some of you may have, if you've flown to Europe, the flights usually fly right over in this direction. Some of you may have seen Europe. If you fly to Norway or Scandinavia, you fly over it. But it's a huge amount of ice here, 10,000 feet at the very top here. What we're seeing here in 1992 was an average year, what we used to have an average. The red shows the thawing levels during the summer. In other words, the thawing levels here were only 800 or 900 feet. We can take a look at 2002. It's going up to 3,000 feet. That's 10 years later. Now notice how it accelerates here, the 4,000 or 5,000 feet. And then we move forward here to 212. Last year, for the first time, the Greenland ice cap thawed all the way to the very top, 10,400 feet. This is very serious. Greenland now is emitting a tremendous amount of ice is going into the ocean. It's accelerating. And at first, we had a sea level rise from the warming of the atmosphere. The warming of the globe was mostly absorbed by the ocean. And as the ocean warmed up, water expands when it warms. So we've had a sea level rise in the last couple of decades from this expansion because of the thermal expansion. But now we're starting for the first time to see the sea level rise that's going forward. And we're now starting to see the effects of the changing climate here in Minnesota. I want to put forth, though, right away that very careful that one weather event, one drought doesn't mean that's climate change. We have to take a look at the statistics, the overall. The fires in Minnesota doesn't necessarily mean that that's climate change, but it has a climate change fingerprint on it when you take a look at all the other statistics around us. This was the Pacami fire in Ely a year ago last fall. This fire ran 18 miles in one day, very dangerous fire. Fortunately, it ran into the wilderness. Otherwise, it would have been a problem. Last May, my little town of Ely almost got torched. We had a fire that came right into town, right to the very edge here. And if it wasn't for the DNR water bombers that were based in Grand Rapids, they showed up, you know, just like the U.S. Cavalry, right on time. The fire was coming into the town of Ely, and these water bombers showed up. And again, Ely's the fire suppression capital of northeastern Minnesota. We're seeing this. This was now the flood in Duluth. I think you had a special session in June here to figure out where the money was coming from. I think you allotted $130 million for this, but that was an extremely costly flood. We had 10 to 12 inches in a very short period of time, something that had never been seen since people had been there, and it basically just washed things down. In southeastern Minnesota, some of you may be from there, we had, in 7 years, we had 3 1,000-year floods, which is pretty unusual. And then the reality check here is the drought. The drought is really, we're going into our third year. Water tables are low. I was just up at the White Bear Chamber of Commerce there, and there's a lot of talk about White Bear Lake, you know, really down 6 feet, and a lot of tourism and so forth really affecting that. So our drought is a very serious proportion. Jay mentioned before that we were all together in the rural areas. We talked to a couple thousand people here right after the election was over, and in the farm areas. And boy, the farmers really talked a lot about this, digging down 6-8 feet, be totally dry all the way down. But we really have to take the weather, the changing weather, really quite serious. It's really imprudent to deny what's going on. We have a responsibility for our children's sake to take serious, to take the science basically out of politics and listen to the warnings that the climate scientists are saying. This is a reality. There's solutions to this, however. 2006 and 2007, Jane and I went around the state right before the RES was signed. We talked to over 50,000 people, 100 congregations. Archbishop Flynn at that time said, it's our moral responsibility to take action on climate. Around this effort, this prompted the Minnesota legislature in February of 2007 to overwhelmingly approve the strongest renewable energy mandate in the country. And I think you're all familiar with the renewable electricity standards, but I think maybe some of you may not be aware of some of the real pluses that we've had, and I wanted to cover that briefly here. 2007, Minnesota adopted the Renewable Energy Standard, RES, requiring utilities to procure enough renewable energy to provide 25% of the retail electrical sale by 2025. For Xcel, it was at 30%. Currently, about 3,000 megawatts of wind power is operating in Minnesota. This is about 15% of our state's annual needs. Presently, we power enough wind. We have enough wind energy for about 1 million homes. And most utilities have already required enough renewable energy to meet their requirements for the next 3 to 7 years. To date, the RES has resulted in over $7 billion of investment in Minnesota. This includes 3,000 Minnesota jobs, $3.6 million in annual tax revenue, and $8 million annual payments in landowners. While the 2007 Minnesota RES contained what's called off-ramps to protect Minnesotans in an unlikely event that the RES requirements required caused negative impacts like economics or reliability, rate reports filed by 13 utilities show that nearly all electrical rates have been either lowered or unaffected by the RES. Xcel reported the rates were lower with wind resources than without. Minnesota Power has had positive impacts on its retail energy portfolio. Outer Tail reported a reduction in their costs. Then one Minnesota utilities, Minnesota River Valley, that has been vocal about rate impacts, made a bad business decision and bought all the renewables at a time at the height of the market, and they had consequences there. So if you hear the negative part of it, it's coming from just a several source. The Minnesota has really benefited from the RES. Utilities are mostly behind this and were much easier than they ever expected it for it to happen. I bring this up because here in Minnesota, we burn equivalent to $20 billion worth of fossil fuel energy. And fossil fuel energy is expensive, it's dirty, there's health problems with it, and fossil fuel is economically volatile. Traveling around Minnesota, talking to Minnesotans, I find that most Minnesotans want a big share of that $20 billion to be coming from our own renewable energy companies that produce high-paying jobs. We look at the success of the RES. We look at where we are now of a public that's really wanting a change. We all know that the public is tired of dysfunctional government. I think we all want government to work. They want their elected officials, Jay and I found out, to take substantial action here on clean energy. I think it's really a political win-win here. And I realize that in some areas of denying and so forth, there's some issues that we have to cover because there is some confusion around the science. That's what we do at the Will Steger Foundation. That's our main mission. But we're finding that that's really starting to change. I specifically work with youth. The youth get it. They, first of all, understand the workings of the climate and the problems that, and the challenges that we're facing. They are demanding new jobs, and I think we do have that responsibility. I look at this basically, the state that we're at right now, making some big decisions here in renewables and conservation, almost like an expedition. Because on an expedition, you know, you take on big, almost unknown, sometimes risks. But on an expedition, one thing that's true on most expeditions I've been, people, we're always one on our purpose, our direction, our goal. And there's just basic steps that we follow. As we bring on the clean energy challenge here, we first break an expedition, you break preparations into achievable tasks. For example, we have solar coming on board. Solar is something that's going to take several years of nurturing to bring on board. Conservation of energy is another real win-win for us. And along with the preparation, you assemble the best team possible, which we have here in Minnesota, I really believe. Then you prepare, build communication and collaboration, leadership structure, and then you set out to accomplish what you have to do. I want to conclude by the future is resting in on your decisions here. I really believe that. We're at a point now where we can go really forward on this, build this economy, build our tax base so we're not scrabbling over the deficit each year. Imagine what $16 billion a year industry and energy of our own energy would be like for our jobs, for our kids, for our tax base, for our schools. We wouldn't have to be scratching around here. We're talking about property taxes and so forth. A lot of this would be eliminated. But it's your decision and your responsibility. And I really thank you for having Jay and I and the rest of the panel here to present our ideas on this.
Thank you very much. I would like to invite the other five presenters to join them at the table. I think there's some extra chairs there. We have about 15 minutes for questions, and I'll just start out with one real brief one, and that is that a lot of the talk was about how some of these things speed up the, multiply the problems. As the global ice cap melts, we get more, less reflective sun stuff. Are there any of the trends that are happening that will mitigate some of the rest of it naturally, or are they all leading the wrong direction that way?
Well, the one thing that leads us in the right direction is that as the Earth heats, it emits more energy. And so that really keeps us from spiraling out of control, so to speak. That is, we call that a feedback. It's a negative feedback. But the principal positive feedbacks and vicious cycle things that can happen are loss of the polar ice cap, which reflects energy, release of methane from the permafrost and methane hydrates under the water, and yeah, those are the two principal positive feedbacks. But hotter things emit more energy, so that helps us.
And Mr. Chair, a number of scientists have noted, including in Science magazine in the last year, that as these impacts from extreme weather reach more and more Americans, that in addition to paying out more in insurance premiums, many more Americans are paying attention to mitigation, to reducing the carbon emissions that are causing the problem. So that is one, perhaps in time, self-correcting mechanism.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hear a recurring theme here, and that is this is very serious. So I'm sitting here wondering how serious should we take what is being shared today? If this information is reality, then why not implement a policy of 100% renewables and outlaw the use of fossil fuels?
Because Rome wasn't built in a day? That might be a great goal, but you have to do that in a way that the economy and society still function. So
this is, Mr. Chair, this is serious, but it's not really that serious, or?
Mr. Chair, it's deadly serious, but as I think it was either Paul Douglas or Mark Seeley pointed out earlier, this is a problem, maybe it's John, this is a problem that we can't fix in a day, And so we have to plan to fix it over a long time period, because you can't just put the brakes on, you can't just stop emitting and have the problem be done. And so this would require the most serious consideration, but also a very deliberate approach to fixing this over the next 5, 10, 20, 40 years. The longer we wait, the harder it will be to fix, but there's no way you can fix it in the next 2 years. It's not something we're going to be, you know, patting ourselves on the back that we fixed in 2 years. It's going to be something our kids will be maybe patting themselves on the back that's fixed by then if we start now.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Brown and members of the committee, when Will Steger and I set out on our 8-forum odyssey around Minnesota 1 month late last year, the big impetus for that was that we were hearing from Minnesotans that they were not aware necessarily that starting in actually the early 90s when Minnesota started investing seriously in energy conservation and energy savings, but then really ramped up in 2007 with the Next Generation Energy Act and the Renewable Energy Standard, most Minnesotans were not aware that these policies existed and the job benefits and the dollar benefits and the savings that had occurred. And what we heard repeatedly during the Q&A period was that people were heartened to learn that Minnesota had already set out on this clean energy path and that we didn't need to do it all in a day, but that we needed to start. Fortunately, we have started thanks to good policy and smart, practical policy, and I think we need to build on that going forward.
Don Shelby and I have had discussions about this. Psychologists say that the public is reluctant to accept a problem until there's an obvious solution, and everybody wants a silver bullet. There is no silver bullet, but there is plenty of silver buckshot. Renewable energy, doubling down on energy efficiencies, making government buildings more resilient as well as energy efficient. The state can be setting the lead and should be setting the lead. And this is going to happen. I mean, I in a market-driven economy, you know, can we dictate thou shalt, or can we lead by example? This is a process. And I sense the tide is turning. And when people realize that they can do something good for the environment and their grandkids and save money, okay, that sounds pretty good. Going green will generate plenty of green.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and presenters, and I apologize. It's budget day, and so I've been in and out, and I'm trying to catch up, and I don't want to argue the science, because what we have to deal with here is very practical things. We talked about solar is coming, and we have a lot of experience in Minnesota with wind power, largely subsidized by a producer tax credit. And I don't think the average Minnesotan knows what's going to happen to their electric bills when the producer tax credit goes away, because Washington's about out of money. If you pay attention, 45% of our producer tax credit is borrowed from our kids. So when we want to talk about our kids, we're going to have some financial reality, some subsidies to deal with. But specifically, if solar's coming to Minnesota to take one power plant offline, you pick nuclear, coal, to take one power plant offline, how many square feet of solar panels do we have to build, and where do you suggest we put it?
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Benson, and you raise a really good question, because Minnesota gets something like 50% of our electricity from burning coal. So this is not something that can or should change overnight, but especially as we find the price of coal and the transportation costs of coal increasing, we're starting to get, I think, more practical about whether we're going to be burning coal in 50- and 60-year-old plants forever, or if it makes more sense for our health and for our economy to diversify. I think we're going to hear a little bit on Thursday, perhaps, about the where the state is at in these reductions. And one thing that I find very interesting is that the Public Utilities Commission has now required four of our biggest utilities to look at what I think is prudent to look at side-by-side cost comparisons of some of their oldest coal plants and compare all of the costs of continuing to run those plants with burning coal but adding pollution controls so they meet current health standards. What are the costs of that versus what would be the cost of replacing those plants? I haven't heard anyone talk about replacing them with any one particular technology. I always think that a diverse set of technologies is the right way to go, and it's the basis of good Minnesota policy that we have diverse sources of generation. And so looking at what is the mix of energy efficiency and conservation, especially industrial energy efficiency, which hasn't really been tapped very well in this state, renewable energy like wind and solar, and look at the combination of that perhaps with natural gas, and looking at the economics of all that. So the PUC is starting to get those studies and to deliberate on side-by-side cost comparisons, and I think that's the right way to begin to look at this problem.
And Mr. Chair, and that's fine. I am very interested in low-cost energy because businesses and families, there's nothing energy doesn't touch. And Great River Energy had to pay an extra $30 million in the last cycle for their wind purchases. So it does really impact budgets. But I asked a very direct question, and you're very thoughtful, numbers-driven people. And I want to make sure that we're thinking about the big picture. Where do we put enough square feet of solar panels to take a traditional power plant offline? And we can combine it with gas peakers because we know the sun doesn't shine all the time, the wind doesn't blow all the time, and so we need that cycling on and off if Minnesotans want to continue a lifestyle where they can turn on the lights at 4:30 and start dinner. And so yes, you can present an abundance of data about what's happening in the climate, but we also have to have some very real information about what those choices mean.
Chair and Senator, that calculation, it's a very doable calculation. I will be happy to do it on a 3M notepad after this and send it out. And I really appreciate the comment because I think we're all here we want smart choices. I mean, we don't just want to choose everything, choose all the green energy technologies and move forward with them simultaneously. We want to choose the ones that are cheapest and most likely of success. Now, I can assure the committee now that the footprint area that would be required to replace a coal power plant is astonishingly low, and I'll provide the numbers after this meeting. But I want to ask a different question. I want to reframe this. Let's talk about the future. Right now, we are subsidizing fossil fuel productions because there is a cost to all of us. I mean, the Duluth flood cost me. The Duluth flood cost all of us. And the people who produce the pollution, which make the Duluth flood happen more often and more intense, they're not paying that cost. And so I'm here as a scientist. I'm not an economist. I don't know the numbers like you do about the various technologies and the policies. But I want to tell you, we don't have another choice. If I look at the science every day, and we are going to be like southern Missouri. You know, the summer we had is going to become the average summer. And when you face that choice, there is no choice. So my appeal to you is, I don't know what the best solution is, whether it's solar, whether it's wind, whether it's this or whether it's that. But you guys are smart. You got to come up with something. I mean, I'll give my suggestions, but you guys, you have to come up with something because there's no other alternative. When you look at the data, when you look at where we're headed as a climate, it's not pretty. And so I'd encourage you to think outside the box and pursue those technologies which are most appealing and most efficient.
And if you could get some information on the square footage.
Absolutely.
Or whatever, that we'll share with the whole committee then if you could.
And just a follow-up, Senator Benson and Mr. Chair, I think what we're seeing from a number of the utilities around the state is when they've been asked to start looking at diversifying away from older coal, that they are not putting all of their eggs or thoughts in one basket, that they're looking at their charge for reliability, affordability, and environmental improvement, which Fresh Energy definitely supports, and that a mixture of resources timed in a way that you're bringing the lowest cost sources in first is the right way to go about that.
Senator Hoffman and Senator Osmet and Senator Brown, and we only have a few minutes, so we'll try and be brief with questions,
please. I'll be brief, Mr. Chair. Thank you. First of all, I thank everybody for coming out here and once again, you know, enlightening us about the direction we need to take, the challenges that are going to be in front of us. Love to hear about American ingenuity and about Minnesota Made. I got the pleasure of watching Dr. Seeley, Paul Douglas, and Dr. Abraham at Champlain Park High School. It was about 3 hours. You really went in depth about it, and it was an eye-opening experience for me and a lot of members from my local community. And I would like to see that full presentation done, and I challenge anybody here to, or actually invite other people here to go and hear you speak. As we look at the addressing climate change, what specific things should we be doing as a committee? I mean, if you look at, and I'm hearing it, you know, like act now, let's get moving on it. But start with one small thing, and what can we start as a committee with one small thing to get started down this right path?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I think looking at the success that Minnesota has had with the Renewable Energy Standard and in growing markets, we heard recently from just one company in Minnesota that has invested $1 billion in wind in Minnesota. And to learn from that approach, which is where you don't pick particular winners and you don't prescribe particular technologies, but for different parts of Minnesota and different service territories, what is the right mix of resources that is going to provide that reliability at the lowest cost, but bearing in mind that there are these health costs and climate costs that we're not yet paying that are going to be internalized. And moving forward, what is the best thing for Minnesota? So to look at what the policies we've got now for the RS through 2025, well, what is the next step? Because I think you'll be hearing over the course of the next few weeks from a number of young people who are going to be certainly our age well after 2025, and they are very concerned about what that future for Minnesota will look like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Osmet.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Actually, my question is for a gentleman who's not sitting here, Mr. Johnson. I'm looking at his premium numbers, and I had questions regarding it appears that he wants to make the case that there's a causal relationship for these premiums going up and up and up. And one thing I want to ask him is what, you know, what he knows for the levels of overheads that insurance companies have experienced over the from 1997 to 2010, there have been different mandates that have been spread across different states changing the field, as well as what he believes to be the primary cost driver of health or of health insurance. I work for a health insurance company. But the primary driver or one of the primary factors, what he believes that primary factor is in actual insurance for homeowners.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I can follow up, Mr. Chairman, with you, Senator, to give you some of the aggregate data in terms of overhead. What are the numbers in terms of, you know, taxes, distribution costs? If you're interested in that, then we can show some of the trends on that over time if you'd like to see that. I don't have that with me here, but we can follow up. I can and get you specific data on that. I think one of the pieces of information I did give, though, was that over the last 5 years that of the claim costs in homeowners in Minnesota, that about 67% of that was wind and hail claims. So it's a very high percentage. I've got a chart that shows the other categories, water damage, so I can get you a chart that gives you the breakout. And we're trying to get that trended over time to show the changing pattern of that, maybe in earlier five-year cycles. So I don't have that right now, Mr. Chairman, but I will follow up with the committee on.
That would be
Senator.
Helpful if you could.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. And, yes, it would be nice to know what are the cost drivers, because a single dollar figure is not a indicative pattern of this is the causal relationship for why this is happening. The other component I wanted to make you alerted of is one of the main drivers for property owners' insurance is their health, their fire rating. I can speak directly from experience that as cities either improve or their fire service decreases, or we spread across a larger area where there are not fire plugs, where there are not fire hydrant services, their fire ratings go down and down and down, which incrementally and significantly in some cases increases their actual homeowners' costs. We actually saw in one of my neighboring cities when they put in more fire services or bought additional fire equipment and had their rating actually drop from an 8 or a 9 down to a 3, which in some cases, some people that were paying $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 actually wound up paying two as a result. So I just wanted to have you bring that in as a factor when you're talking about this, because I could see that you're trying to make a correlation, but in reality there are so many moving parts that just the numbers going up doesn't maybe necessarily tell you a story that this has got to do with the claims themselves. Thank you.
Yeah, if you could bring that information. And Senator Brown, did you have one?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand that Rome wasn't built in a day, but your testimony, I heard from all of you, I sensed a sense of urgency on what needs to be done. So if people-produced pollution is stimulating our change in climate, how urgent are things? How urgent? What kind of timetable do we need to be on? And what recommendations would you make? I heard Senator Hoffman talk about small changes. My sense is, from your testimony, small changes aren't going to do it. So I would just like an idea as a legislator. How urgent is this? What type of timetable are we looking at? And what recommendations would you make?
Chairman and Senator, it depends on what risk we're willing to take. In some cases, it's too late. But if we take action now, we can avoid other things that might happen. Let me give you an example. I talk to many cryosphere experts, people whose expertise is on ice, and many of them think we are already going to lose Greenland no matter what we do. It may take hundreds of years or 1,000 years for all of Greenland to melt, but it's something that may not be reversible today. On the other hand, there are some things that we could still avoid, like methane release, excessive methane release, which would make the problem very, very bad. So it really depends on what issue you're talking about. Now, the general consensus is to keep to give us a reasonable chance, about a 50-50 chance of staying below 2 Celsius, or about 3.5 to 4 degrees Fahrenheit global temperature rise, we have to get about 80 to 100% reduction in carbon dioxide by the end of the century. So with that as a market, I'm sure there's a number by 2050. And that's why you hear talk about 350 ppm or parts per million, or 450 ppm parts per million. Now, the end of the century is a long time, and it may suggest that you've got a long time to act, but the fact is emissions, carbon dioxide that we put in the atmosphere now are going to be in the atmosphere at 2100. So why are we suggesting a sense of urgency? Why is there a sense of urgency? Because once it's in the air, it's going to stay in the air for long periods of time. And the longer we wait, the harder it is to get it out. There aren't really carbon dioxide scrubbers that we can clean air from its carbon dioxide, or clean carbon dioxide from the air. So the urgency is related to these two things. One is trying to avoid some of these what are called tipping points. Some we've passed, some we haven't passed. And two, because the longer we wait, the costlier and more difficult it will be to mediate them.
And Senator Brown, Chairman, I heard the question earlier, what is it that this legislature and this legislative committee can do? And I think on Thursday you're going to hear from state agencies about where the state is on the science-based carbon emission reduction goals, which in Minnesota call for at least 80% emission reductions by 2050, so based on science. And I think the next step would be figuring out where we're at there. And that's a long time, so that's not tomorrow, but it clearly says Minnesota is on a low-carbon path. To find out where we're at on that path and to lay out a practical set of solutions that is really going to work for Minnesota at the lowest cost and get us to that place that we know we need to be.
I want to thank all the members of the panel for taking the time to be with us. On Thursday, we're going to be looking at where Minnesota is and what next steps may be, and this will be an issue that's going to be coming forward. I thank you for a thoughtful presentation. I think it's, in many ways, it is alarming. The risks that we face, they are so severe in many ways, and we don't want to frighten people. We want to create a sense of urgency that we have to address it. And I think you've all been very helpful to the committee, and I thank you very much for coming. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.